Hello, this is Gideon Rothstein, and this is a responsive day for the 13th of Tevet. We're going to start with a tshuva that will end up being a very short tshuva by Rav Chaim Moser Grudzinski. I think that, you know, we saw one by Rav Chaim Moser Grudzinski yesterday. I think he just happened to think about 2 days in a row in my searches, and I had noticed that I hadn't used him a lot, and then I haven't had many since, so it's sort of an odd thing how it comes up, but sometimes in the others. In any case, it's Shur Achiezer, the third volume in responsive number 72. He's got a bunch of short tshuvot, short responses to various rabbanim, and one of them is from the 13th of, they're all from, they're dated the 13th of Tevet of Tafresh Tzadi Dalid, which was actually the 31st of December of 1933, so it's still 1933 in the non-Jewish calendar, and it collects various short tshuvot to write to other people. And originally, I was going to do the first one at somewhat greater length than we will, but it ends up being about selling a shul. And I want to make clear, I don't choose these tshuvot in order, meaning that when I've done, we just saw that on the 6th of Tevet, but I don't sit down to do the tshuva for the 6th of Tevet and 7 days later do the tshuva, find the tshuva for the 13th of Tevet. I found these at various times in various situations, so that the fact that I hit upon the same theme twice is just because I guess it's an idea that I found interesting. So I'm not going to do it at any length whatsoever because we've seen it before. We saw it, you know, a week ago, and if you don't remember it, go back and see, because the Sri the Asian fact echoes much of what the Achiezer writes in this tshuva as well. So that's a topic we can leave for another time. The next tshuva, though, is then they'll come. There's one that I skipped completely, and then there's one that's going to come in a second that that we'll see is also a repeat theme of ours that we've seen. But the third tshuva in this, in the third one of the short response, actually brings up an interesting question that we haven't spoken about a lot before. There's a woman who's ill with, he says, machalat hare'ah, which I think means tuberculosis, consumption, you know, it's a lung disease of some sort. And the doctor is saying, she got pregnant, and the doctors say that if she carries the baby to birth, to full term, and she has the baby, then she'll die. So they have to abort the baby, or they say there's danger to her life. They think there's a good chance that she'll die in giving birth. So the person who's writing him the letter says to the had thought that she can't do anything about it, and he thought she can't do anything about it because when the Rambam paskins that a woman, that we abort babies to save the mother, as the halach is, the way the Rambam writes it is, the Rambam talks about the case of where in the process of childbirth, there's danger to the mother. So because the Mishnah and the Gemara spoke about aborting the baby, and there they say more graphically that we don't need to get into, but you abort the baby, and the phrase the Rambam uses is "Neshehu kirodef achareha," that it's as if he's like trying to kill her. And we have a general halacha that if somebody's trying to kill somebody else, and the only way to save the potential victim is by killing the rodent, by killing the one pursuing her, pursuing the potential victim, then we do that. We stop the pursuer in whatever way we can. That's the phrase the Rambam uses it. So the man writing the letter to Reb Chaim Moser Grudzinski says, shouldn't that mean that we'd have to wait until she starts having the baby? At the point that she starts having the baby, that's when there's the actual immediate threat to life, and that would be when we'd be able to abort it. But to abort it now, when all there is the possibility, he says he doesn't see it because the baby's not a rodef yet. Chaim Moser rejects that assumption, although he's not going to reject that problem in terms of giving her an abortion on the basis of this. Chaim Moser says, you're right. He thinks that if somebody's a rodef, it doesn't matter if it's now or in the future, as long as we can already apply fully the din of a rodef, the rule of a rodef to that person, then it shouldn't matter. So that's an interesting thing to think about, not in our context, but in lots of other contexts. So, you know, it comes up in complicated questions of, let's talk about, you know, you mentioned the terrible idea that Yigal Amir had, that Yitzchak Rabin was a rodef. Yitzchak Rabin, the prime minister of Israel, by virtue of his actions, was going to put Jews in danger. And by virtue of putting Jews in danger, we could kill him if that's the only way we could stop him from putting those Jews in danger. We'll see in a second that Reb Chaim Moser is going to say that a Suffolk rodef, you can't kill. You can't save a Suffolk. I mean, if we have doubts about somebody's a rodef, that was easily the problem, one of the problems, there are probably many, but one of the problems with the Yitzchak Rabin situation was that there was no way that he was definitely a rodef. But Reb Chaim Moser does imply that if I know somebody is a rodef, I don't have to wait until they're in the act of rodef. So, for example, let's suppose I had confirmed information that somebody was planning on, you know, committing the Boston Marathon bombing. I had well-established information about these two guys, But my last opportunity to stop them would have been days before the event. And the only way that I could effectively stop them would have been by killing them. All of that is very speculative, and I'm not saying that it's true. I'm saying, theoretically, if that were true about a situation, or let's say I knew somebody who was planning on bombing somebody else, and I knew that the last time I was going to see them, they were about to go off the grid, however they were going to go off the grid, effectively, and I wouldn't find them again. The only time I could find them is when they pick up the bomb from the bomb maker. But when they pick up the bomb, they're not a Rodef right then, because they're not planning on setting it off until they get to wherever their destination is. So Reb Chaim Lozer seems to be saying, and I think you'd have to talk about this if it ever came up in practice, but seems to be saying that once we know somebody is a Rodef, somebody is established Rodef, we have the right to stop that Rodef with whatever we need to do, the minimum force that is effective, but with effective force. So therefore, if this, come back to our situation, of the baby is a Rodef, in the fact that the Rambam uses that phrasing when talking about a baby, a fetus that's threatening the mother's life, if that's true, then it doesn't matter if the baby is doing it now or in the future, as long as this process is not going to change and this element has a Rodefa to it, then it should be that you'd be able to stop it. Here, however, he says it's not a Rodef, it's a Suffolk Rodef. Why is it a Suffolk Rodef? Because we're not positive that she's going to be in life-threatening danger, meaning they said that women in this condition who have babies tend to be endangered, have their lives be endangered because of the combination of the illness of giving birth. So Suffolk Rodef, says Reb Chaim Lozer, you're not allowed to save the victim by killing the Suffolk Rodef, because it's only Suffolk, it's only a doubt, you're not allowed to do that. Not only that, he says, since the doctor says it's only possible that this will be life-threatening, and that gets us questions of percentages that I've discussed on other occasions, right? There's a lot of times when people say, oh, you know, there's a threat to life, and you say, what are the percentages? They say, I mean, it's 50-50. So if it's literally 50-50, even if it's 80-20 that the person would pass away, it's still somewhat of a suffix. So in halacha, we tend to follow the rove, we tend to follow the majority, but in many situations, people would say, oh, if it's a 20% chance you die, that's unacceptable. It might be true that it's unacceptable in general, but it would certainly affect our halachic observations about the situation, right? Let's say somebody came to, leaving aside the pregnancy question, somebody came to somebody else and said, there's a 20% chance you'll die if you do X, Y, or Z. Does that mean they're not allowed to do it in halacha because they're putting themselves into absolute risk of death? I think that's a complicated question. Or if they have a disease and they say, you have to take this medication, otherwise there's a 20% chance that you'll die, and if you don't take the medication, 20% chance you'll die. If you do take the medication, it'll make you miserable for 6 months or whatever it is. So I think that's a question, Allah, and I think that's what Chaim Lozer is talking about. When you have a suffix, when you have a doubt about it, so that's a whole question. Then he goes on to say, and maybe this is somewhat different in the 1930s than it is now, but not completely, because I think even today, I would think this is something we don't pay enough attention to. He says, "Be'ikar ne'emanut ha'rofei, kvar katav ha'chatam sofer, shezeu rak midin safek pikuach nefesh." The whole idea of believing doctors when they make predictions about the future, the Chatam Sofer says that halachically, the Chatam Sofer is writing in the early 1800s, so it could easily be that some of the things, or many of the things that doctors say today, have achieved a greater level of halachic standards of truth. But nonetheless, in the 1930s, Reb Chaim Lozer is saying that when a doctor says this will lead to danger of death, that still only creates a suffix in halacha. Now, I think today, very often you have good statistics on what they're talking about. So where you do have good statistics, it would be different if he says 90% of the women who face this situation end up dying, or if he says 27% of the women who end up facing the situation end up dying. 27% is still a lot of women, and you still might want to think about it. And we'll get to his conclusion is going to be completely different than what he's indicating right now. If it sounds like he's going to tell you she can't have an abortion, hold on a second, because he's going to tell you she can, but for a completely different reason. But in terms of, and this applies to lots of other medical situations that come up, in terms of when doctors predict things, what those predictions do or don't mean to us, so he says that in halacha, there's a lot of room to say that we don't have to take it as seriously as many people tend to. So then he says he doesn't think, though, that the truth is that you have to take this Rodef comparison all that seriously, because if you look in the original Gemara, it doesn't say the baby is a Rodef, it says Dimishmaya Karad Fela. From heaven, they are chasing her. And Rashi there explains that the ubar, the fetus, is not considered a soul of its own. It's not a life of its own. And therefore, it's that Hashem is doing something to her, but that virtue of that, she has the right. So that's when the baby comes out. So until then, she has the right to protect herself, is what the Gemara seems to mean. And then he points out that Rabbi Yehuda explained that the Rambam wrote the whole idea that the baby is, think of the baby as a Rodef, because the Rambam wanted to explain why are we allowed to kill the ubar, the fetus, to save the mother, because after all, it's, so you'll say to me, well, the baby's not a life yet. So it's not fully a life yet, but it's somewhat a life. This is the Ner Rabbi Yehuda. This is the Ner Rabbi Yehuda that Chaim Moser is referring to. The Ner Rabbi Yehuda says, it's somewhat a life. So he says, for example, let's say I have somebody who's a trefa. Trefa is a person who's got a wound. It also theoretically applies to an illness, but a wound that will necessarily kill them. So a trefa is a person who we know will die soon, and for some halakhic purposes, is not the same as a full human being. So for example, you can't get the death, it's not allowed, you're not permitted to kill a trefa, but if somebody kills a trefa, they don't get the death penalty in court for it. So there are some senses in which halakhically, a trefa is not as fully alive, as it were, as a person about whom we don't have any information that death is imminent. So then he says, but that would in no way mean that we're allowed to kill a trefa just to help just to save a regular person. There is no such halakha. So the Nebuchadnezzar says that would have been true, should have been true, about a fetus as well. A fetus is not fully alive yet, but it's on the way to being alive. And if anything else, nothing else changes, it will be alive. Even if the birth kills the mother, not that we're hoping for it, but even if the birth were to kill the mother, the baby very often would come out alive. So the Rebbe says what the Rambam means to say by calling the baby a rodev is to explain why halakhically we're allowed to abort the fetus to save the mother's life. We abort the fetus because the fetus is not fully alive. That ordinarily says that the Rebbe would not have allowed us to do an abortion, because we don't ordinarily say if you have person not fully alive person X and fully alive person Y, we don't say, well, it's fine to kill person X to save person Y. That would have been true of the abortion case as well, says the Rebbe Yehuda, which is why the Rambam added, well, in this case, the baby is a rodef, and that's why we're allowed to do it. So all of that was in other situations. And would not yet have worked out for here, because here the baby's not doing anything to her, right? All of those situations where in the process of childbirth the mother seems to be dying, and therefore we abort the baby. And that's what the Achiezer comes back to say now. That's all about where she's having trouble giving birth. She's already started giving birth. The reason why that's different, he says, is that once she started giving birth, so then it's what's called akar havalad. The baby has started moving out of the woman's body, and therefore is now thought of as a separate body. Once the fetus is a body of its own, so then the calculation is, I've got two bodies, which one do I destroy to save the other, right? Am I required to let the mother be killed by the birth process, or am I allowed to take this separate body and destroy it, the fetus that was about to come out, in order to save the mother? And that's where the Rebbe wanted to explain that that's where the halakhic conclusion became, that since the fetus is not yet fully alive, it hasn't come out yet, so it's not yet fully alive, it's a separate body, and it's a rodev, it's the cause of the danger to the mother, we're allowed to abort the baby. All that is separate from our case, however, says the Achiezer, because until the point where she's had birth, where she's starting to give birth, where she's where the birth process has started, she's got the contractions, she's in labor, she's going, you know, she's in the chair, she's ready. Until all of that happens, the Rambam paskins and ubar yerech imo, that we think of a fetus as a body part of the mother, for lots of halakhic purposes that we don't need to get into here. But the fetus is considered a part of the mother. If the fetus is a part of a mother, says the Achiezer, so then think of any other body part. If a woman has a body part that is threatening her life, what do we do? Right, let's say, suppose somebody, God forbid, gets gangrene in their foot or their arm, and the only way we know to protect the person from having the gangrene spread and destroying the rest of the person is we amputate. And nobody would say, well, what about the rights of the hand? So the halacha is, says the Achiezer, and this also would have lots of ramifications that he doesn't get into here, but the halacha is that until the woman, until the baby starts to move out, until the birth process starts, the baby is considered a part of the mother. And if that's true, then if we have reasonable medical advice that this baby, this fetus, will constitute a danger to the mother, so at that point already, once we know that, it's one of her body parts that is causing her a problem, like a tumor, like this, like that, and you're allowed to remove it. So that is how and why the Achiezer says, absolutely, you're allowed to save this woman's life by aborting this baby, and it doesn't matter when you do it, because once the doctors have determined that the fetus will constitute a danger to her life, then you're allowed to go through the difficult and painful process of aborting it to save the mother's life. last piece of this Tshuva Ne'akezer, we're also not going to do a lot because it's about cremation. But it is striking to me that I think three different times in close proximity to each other, I encounter Tshuvot having to do with cremation. I try to pick these Tshuvot as randomly as I can, but apparently when I was picking them, I got caught up in a theme where it like occurred to me, I was noticing it, and so therefore I got into it. The only thing that I'd add here is that here the Achiezer says straight out that it's proper and appropriate not to bury Jews who have themselves cremated in a Jewish cemetery, and he says it's a creative protest, and that we sometimes halachically do things that are not necessary, but that are protective. And here, you've got this thing of cremation that's beginning to spread in the 1930s. You want people to know they're not allowed to do it. So we say, one of the things we say is, if we have the ability to do so, we say, we're not burying you in our Jewish cemetery. So that's just a protective measure that you have. So that's Shirach Yezer from the 13th of Tevet, mainly about the issue about that interesting abortion question, where he concludes that a fetus inside its mother is considered a part of the mother, and therefore the standards for whether we can abort to save the mother's life are in fact more lenient than they would be if she was already in the process of giving birth, because if she was in the process of giving birth, so then it would be a separate body, and then you have to weigh the rights of one body against the other. But until she's in the process of giving birth, then it's a question of, like any other body part, if the body part is threatening the mother, threatening the woman, what do we do and what do we allow in that situation? Then for another tshuva, because we might as well use our time well. The Rav Yovad Yosef in Yabia Omer Chelek Zion, Volume 7, the Yeridea section, Simon Mem Aleph, this from the 13th of Tevet of Tafshin Lamed, which was still 1969, late December of 1969. He was asked a question about, he's writing to a man who was writing back to him. He had Paskin, Rav Yosef had apparently Paskin in the fifth volume of Yabia Omer, that if you have, sadly, a groom who's in Shloshim for a parent, right? So he is in Avel, he is in mourning, and the wedding was all set, so the halacha is, especially if he has not yet had children, that he's allowed to go forward with the wedding, because he has yet children, in the midst of a period of Arivya, he has the midst of having children, he can go forward with the wedding. And sometimes you'll have to go forward with the wedding, or not have to, but you'll want to go forward with the wedding, because there's money that's been paid, there's arrangements that have been made, and the halacha is they're allowed to. Rav Yosef said, he's allowed to have a band at the wedding as well, and they can have dancing, and they can have singing, and the Rav Yosef had paskin that is because the Iker Simcha of Chasan and Kala is having a band there, and having singing and dancing, and that's the way you create the joy, and the main part of the joy of the Chasan and Kala. And he quotes a Maharil, who had said that one time, the ruler of a certain area had ruled that there shouldn't be any musical instruments played for a whole year, because the ruler's wife had died. So to mark her passing, and to show how much he missed her, and how sad he was, he said, nobody in this whole kingdom, right, this whole duchy, this whole whatever it was, that area, would be allowed to use musical instruments. So they came to ask the Maharil, what should they do? This is, the Maharil is like the 1400s. He was born in 1360, and he passed away in 1427, and passed away in Worms. Yeah, so it's like in a German community. And they asked the Maharil what they should do, and he said they shouldn't have the wedding there without musical instruments, because musical instruments in a band is essential to the Simcha of Chasan and Kala, of the bride and the groom, and therefore if it's impossible to do in that place, they have to do the wedding somewhere else. That's what he posited. So Rav Yosef is quoting that to show how essential it is to the process of having a wedding to have music there. And that's why the Rama wrote in Or HaChaim, in Shin Lamed Chet, the Rama had said you can even allow a non-Jew on Shabbos fix musical instruments so that you can have somebody play them at a Simchas Chasam Nekala. The Rambam had said you can fix it. I thought it must be for after Shabbos, but it actually seems to be on Shabbos, where the Shulchan Aruch says that there's those who hold that you can have non-Jews play music for a chuppah. So it's unclear to me, because in Shin Lamed Tet, the Shulchan Aruch paskens that you can't have kiddushin or marriages on Shabbos. I'm not sure what they're talking about. It might be means like for a Sheva Brach celebration. It might be that they have the chuppah already Friday, but they're having a celebration that night. In any case, the Shulchan Aruch quotes that there are those who say you can have non-Jews play, because playing musical instruments on Shabbos is a Durabbanan, and telling non-Jews to do things is a Rabbanan, so it's a Shvut to Shvut, and there's a Makam Mitzvah. Mishnah Berurah there says, because Ikar, Simchas Chasam Nekala, the main joy of the Chasen Kala is having the music there. So the Ramah says you might even be able to tell them to fix musical instruments because so it's important. The fundamental point being that it shows how important that it is to have music at a wedding, that it's really the mitzvah. It's part of the mitzvah. It's essential to the mitzvah, and therefore it's considered a shvut to shvut. The Malka Mitzvah may be a one shvut, right? Even so, fixing the musical instruments might be a Doraita issue. So if you're having a non-Jew do it, it might be a shvut echad, like only one shvut, and yet you're allowing it in the place of mitzvah. And then he quoted other people. The Maharil had said, not the Maharil, the Knesset Agdola had said on the base of this Maharil that if a man is getting married in Zavil 12 months, then he can also do it. So that's going to be important because that says the same exact idea, except that's 12 months, not shloshim. We're going to come back to that. The Chidah had allowed not only for a wedding, he allowed somebody who was making a bris, right? Man has a baby, and he's an avel, and you're having a bris. The Chidah said you can have music at the bris as well, and you can also have, even though not the man, the mother wasn't in avelus of 12 months for her father, and so he says you can't. So apparently in those days, having music at a bris was also central to the ceremony of the bris. So the man writing Rav Yosef says all that doesn't prove that you can do it in the 12 months. In the Shloshim, it only says the 12 months. But Rav Yosef said you can do it in Verchasen in Shloshim. Right? So that's a new level, he says. So Rav Yosef, you're right that 12 months and Shloshim are very different times. Because 12 months is a matter of, people call it Avelus. They say, I'm in Avelus from my parents. But as Rav Yosef says here in the Tshuva, it's not actually Avelus, it's a question of Kibud Avayim. There's a halacha that out of respect for our parent who has passed away, we refrain from attending experiences of joy to show our respect for them. But it's not a matter of mourning, whereas Shloshim is a matter of mourning. Shehu Sharoi says of Yosef, Be'evil Mamish, but in actual mourning. But, he says, I don't think that valid distinction that many people don't notice, but that these two people notice, and that is important for us to remember, the distinction between mourning and acting out of honor or respect for our parents who has passed away, that's not relevant to our halacha, he says. He says there's a man who wrote, Rav Baruch Frankel, who wrote Imre Baruch on the Shulchan Aruch, who said that as well, who said that somebody who has not yet fulfilled the mitzvah period of Rav, he's not yet had children, and he's already prepared a chuppah, and then the brother of the bride passes away. He says he can marry her during Shloshim, and they can have a full marriage. That's what the Shulchan Aruch says. And the Imre Baruch says, he thinks that you can even have at the wedding, you can have dancing with music, because since the chuppah, he gives a couple of reasons, the Imre Baruch. And Rav Yosef is not going to accept all the reasons. The Imre Baruch says, one, he thinks the chuppah is like a holiday for the chatan and kala. So if it's a holiday, on holidays you're not allowed to have public mourning. So if she were to refrain from music and dancing, you'd say, oh, it's because she's in Avelut, and then everybody would know that she's observing her Avelut. But if it's a holiday, she's not allowed to. Second reason, he says, is also, there is no such thing in our reality of a wedding without a band. And to have a wedding without a band is like everybody will know what's going on. And also, since they're allowed to get married, inherent in allowing them to get married is having a band, because it's so essential to the experience of a wedding. And then finally, he said, the Imre Baruch said, if the bride is in Avelut, the groom is in Avelut, and we're sort of limiting his simcha, and you shouldn't do it. So Rav Yosef doesn't like that first reason of avelut in public, because he doesn't think avelut in public is an issue, because it's not really a regel. But he thinks the other reasons are good reasons. One is that it's essential to a wedding, and the second is, he says, for our case, the case of the Imre Baruch was where the bride was in avelut, but the case that Rav Yosef had ruled on, the chatan was in avelut, the groom was the one who was in mourning. The groom was in mourning, she's not in the mourning, the bride is not in mourning, and he has an obligation, says Rav Yosef, the husband has an obligation to make his wife happy. There's a pasuk in the Torah that says, "Mesimach ad ishto asher lakach." That's in the context of him not going to war, but it says he should stay with her for the whole first year after their marriage and make all the efforts of the world to make her happy. So he says, the Rav Yosef says, that's a mitzvah. And so when he's making the wedding, he's got to do it in a way that will make her happy. That's part of the mitzvah. And then he notes, the Netziv did not think that was a mitzvah. And Rav Yosef says, I think he's wrong. He doesn't say it like that. He says it much more gently. He says, I don't think he's correct. Meaning, meaning where the Netzivit said it's giving him permission to avoid doing things by virtue of the fact that he needs to be with his wife. And but he says, if you Ravad Yosef says, if you look at the Sefer HaKinuch and the other poskim, it doesn't seem that way. It seems to take it as a serious obligation on a husband to make his best efforts to make his wife happy, and that would include having a band at the wedding. And he quotes another source that says the same thing about a bris, a shut mas avram, which says that they're common things to have a band at the bris, to have music at the bris, and all the more so for a groom, which is even more of a serious, much more of a need for simcha and more of an occasion of simcha with music than even a brit. Fundamentally, he thinks that the idea is that once we've allowed the wedding, it means we've allowed the music. Right, they're inherent together. So if we say that the needs of a man to fulfill the mitzvah of having children is sufficient to allow him to get married within Shloshim, and it's that, right, then that includes in it, it carries along with it, the need to have a band as well. He gives an example from the Gemara. The Gemara talks about the mitzora shechal shmini shlo be'er Pesach, then ra'a keri. If you have a mitzora who's finishing up his process of getting being healed, halakhically healed, and halakhically allowed to go back to the Beit HaMikdash, and then on that day, another lower form of tumah, lower form of ritual impurity happens to him. So we say that even though in general, somebody who went to mikvah that day and needs the evening before he becomes fully tahar, which would be what happened with a baal keri, with somebody who had that lower form of ritual impurity, nonetheless here, since this person is going to be allowed to go in because of his tzara'at, so therefore it's going to carry along with it the other things as well. So that idea, Rav Yosef applies here as well, that what he means is, since we've allowed the wedding, then the band comes along with the wedding. It's a much lower form of breaking the Avelut, as it were, and therefore if we're allowed to have him suspend his Avelut or not observe his Avelut during the course of the wedding for the purposes of being able to get married and beginning on the process of having children, then it includes a band with it as well. Then the man who had written the letter knew of a tshuva in the Binyan Sion, Chelek Aleph, Volume 1, the end of Simon Kuf Lametet 139, where the Binyan Sion says to some of the person he's writing to that the fact that you told a couple that they shouldn't have wedding music and dancing at their wedding, and the chatan was the groom, was a mourning for his parents. So the Binyan Sion said, that was a good idea. Congratulations, you gave the right psak. So Rav Yosef says you missed the point. That issue wasn't really an issue of Avelus. That issue was there was going to be mixed dancing at that wedding. And the Binyan, see, this is in the early to mid-1800s, so it's telling us things about the way the past went that we might not have always thought. We might have always thought that Jews were this level of observant or that level of observant. But Binyan Sion is dealing with a situation where there's mixed dancing. He's not happy about it, because if he said, Rav Yosef says, if you read the rest of the letter, he says, and if you can stop them from dancing at all the weddings, that would be even better. Because when you have mixed dancing, says the Binyan Sion, that's not a simcha shel mitzvah anymore. It's not a joy of a mitzvah. It's an abizrayhu of gilui arayos. It is an extension of sexual immorality. Today, I know many people who mock this halachic attitude, and it's unfortunate, but let's be clear that already in the early 1800s, and I provide you safe things so too, the idea of mixed dancing was seen as something that could easily lead people to have further sexual thoughts about each other and then even to act further sexually with each other. I know, not that I've been involved in a lot of mixed dancing, but I've seen some on TV and in the movies and whatever, and I think that the people who reject this out of hand are not paying nearly enough attention to the way dancing is carried out between men and women. Various kinds of, all the kinds of dancing that people talk about. Dancing that goes on, mixed dancing, has that element to it. So Rav Yosef stops and says, now this is something that people have complained about. The Gdoli Yisrael, the great Torah scholars, have always had this problem with men and women dancing together. And he quotes another tshuva, in any case. So the Binyan Sion says is not relevant to our situation, because he wasn't really saying that a mourner shouldn't have dancing at his wedding, because the truth is that was at a wedding that Binyan Sion didn't want to have dancing at all for other reasons. The fact that the man found an excuse, the rabbi found an excuse to say, now, it turns out that he sort of, Rav Yosef is sort of understanding Binyan Sion to have said, you used a reason that's not actually true, because they could have had music at the wedding. I'm not sure the Binyan Sion would have agreed they could have had, right? He, to agree that they could have had music at the wedding would have meant that he had already anticipated Revi Yosef's idea that even in Shloshim, somebody's allowed to have music at a wedding because it's inherent to a wedding to have music. I'm not sure the Ben Yitzchak would have gone that far. But Revi Yosef's point is the Ben Yitzchak wasn't ruling on that question. The Ben Yitzchak was just saying it's great that you found a reason not to have music at that wedding because the Ben Yitzchak didn't want music at any weddings because in his time, that would have meant mixed dancing. And he thought that mixed dancing was terrible enough that you'd rather have a wedding without music than a wedding with music and mixed dancing. And Revi Yosef, for all that he thinks music is so essential to a wedding, seems to agree that if it's necessary to the fact that music will be that they'll have mixed dancing, it's probably better not to have the music at all. So that's a whole subtext of what happens at weddings and how you construct weddings and what kinds of activity we do or don't have at weddings and when there's appropriate behavior or inappropriate behavior that's going to be going on. He closes by noting, I skipped a little piece about what counts as logical or intuitive that I would love to have gotten to, but we're running out of time, so let's just skip to, he notes that the Sefer Chassidim, which many people follow for many issues, especially on things like this, did say very clearly that if somebody was, that there was a case of a man who passed away, and he told his son to get married after Shloshim, so this is after Shloshim, and then they consulted with the local rabbi who said they shouldn't have musical instruments at all. So it sounds like even after Shloshim, you shouldn't have music at the wedding. So Revi Yosef says he thinks that might be in the house. The custom used to be that you get married in private homes, and that was going to be in the home where the man had passed away, the father had passed away. So in that situation, there's this tradition that the soul of a person has passed away comes back to earth, as it were, travels in the earth in some way. There's more in Shabbos that talks about it throughout the first year after they passed away. So if they're going to have a wedding there, the soul might be there in some way, and then you really shouldn't have musical instruments. But when, as in our times, weddings are made in halls or in a shul, so therefore, Revi Yosef thinks it's all fine, and he thinks you should and could have musical instruments at the weddings because it's so essential to the experience of the Simchat Chatan Mekala, the joy of the Chatan Mekala. And that is, those are a responsive today, really two responsive for today, the 13th of Teveit. Have a great day.